In other instances, it was to reward support for the Entente during the war and to punish the subjugated enemy. Romania, for example, was a major beneficiary, doubling its size, largely at the expense of Hungary. In Central Europe, Austria, Hungary, and Germany were major losers in the territorial redistribution. Rejoicing among the winners from the territorial settlement was more than matched by dismay, anger, and smouldering resentment among the losers. In Italy, the fury over Fiume played into the hands of the rabid nationalists. The proto-fascist poet Gabriele D'Annunzio, who had himself coined the phrase mutilated victory to imply that Italy had been cheated out of rightful gains from the war, made the case of Fiume his own, and in mid-September 1919 led a motley paramilitary force into a bizarre occupation of the small Adriatic town, which lasted for 15 months. In the Treaty of Rapallo, signed between Italy and Yugoslavia in November 1920, Fiume was eventually designated a free city with land links to Italy. But Fiume remained a banner for the fascists, who were gathering strength in Italy, and it was to be annexed by Benito Mussolini in 1924. However difficult proved so many of the territorial issues arising from the war that the Big Four gathered in Paris had to deal with, their central and overriding priority was Germany. They were unanimous in holding Germany primarily to blame for the great conflagration. In their eyes, the invasion of France, for the second time in just over 40 years, and the breach of Belgian neutrality, accompanied by atrocities against the civilian population, pointed the finger of blame squarely at Germany. The questions of punishment and retribution for the exorbitant costs of the war were therefore the most pressing concerns of the Allied leaders. More crucial still was ensuring that Germany should never again be in a position to plunge Europe into war. German militarism and industrial muscle might, if not sufficiently tamed, again threaten Europe's peace. On the other hand, Germany's economic importance to a future Europe was obvious. Moreover, crushing Germany, which would have been popular in France especially, might open the door for Bolshevism to spread into the heart of Europe. A problem for the Allies was that many Germans didn't recognize that their country had been militarily defeated. Germany was undestroyed after 4 years of war. No Allied troops had stood on German soil at the armistice, though German forces at that time still occupied much of Belgium and Luxembourg. German soldiers were welcomed home with festive flags and flowers. The Prussian War Ministry declared soon after the armistice that our field grey heroes returned to the Heimat undefeated. It was untrue, but the sentiment was repeated by the high command of the army. Then, in December 1918, by no less a person than the new socialist head of government, Friedrich Ebert. The legend soon to be put about by the counter-revolutionary right that the troops at the front had been stabbed in the back by labour unrest fomented by revolutionary socialists at home, could germinate in fertile soil. When the Allied terms were announced in early May 1919, the palpable shock in Germany was much greater than it would have been had its military defeat been obvious. The terms were severe, though not as harsh as those that the Germans had imposed on the Russians at Brest-Litovsk in March 1918, and too lenient for the liking of French public opinion, thirsting for much more draconian punitive measures. Germany was to lose some 13% of its pre-war territory in Europe, including rich agricultural and industrial regions mainly in the east, resulting in the exclusion of around 10% of its pre-war population of 65 million. In economic terms, the losses were damaging but not irreparable. The real damage was political and psychological, the heavy blow to national pride and prestige. The sense of humiliation was heightened by the Allied stipulations for demilitarization. The once mighty German army, which had still managed to put about 4.5 million men in the field in 1918, was to be reduced to a mere 100,000 men, and conscription was barred. The Navy, whose ships and submarines had been taken into Allied hands or destroyed after the armistice, was reduced to 15,000 men. No submarines were to be permitted in future, and Germany was banned from having a military air force. The anger in Germany at the territorial changes was immense, and it crossed political and ideological boundaries. The Treaty of Versailles was denounced as a victor's diktat. "I'm in no doubt that the treaty must be revised," wrote the diplomat Bernhard von Bülow in 1920. "We must use the monstrosity of the treaty and the impossibility of implementing so many of its stipulations in order to bring down the entire Versailles peace." There were certainly some awkward hostages to fortune should Germany ever become powerful again. Danzig, today's Gdansk, for instance, an almost entirely German industrial port, but now surrounded by Poland, was designated a League of Nations free city with Polish access to necessary coastal trading facilities. Another fudge was produced to educate on the Saarland, lying on the border with France and industrially important because of its coal and iron ore deposits, so coveted by the French, though mainly German populated. The French were given ownership of the mines, but the Saarland itself was placed under League of Nations administration for a 15-year period, after which the inhabitants could decide by plebiscite whether they wanted to belong to France or Germany or retain the status quo. Yet another uneasy arrangement was reached on the Rhineland. The French, desperate to ensure lasting security, wanted a permanent Allied occupation of the almost wholly German-populated area, and Germany's western border to be fixed at the Rhine. France had to settle for occupation of the Rhineland for a period of 15 years. The Germans were powerless to do anything about it, but the deep sense of grievance didn't go away. Other painful amputations of German territory also played into the hands of nationalists, who, even if forced to bide their time, kept alive hopes of a later revision of the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. In the West, the changes were relatively insignificant. The small, predominantly German-speaking border area of Eupen-Malmedie was given to Belgium. The northern part of Schleswig, mainly Danish-speaking, went to Denmark. But in the east, the territorial losses were more acutely felt. What became known as the Polish Corridor took away West Prussia and Posen from Germany, incorporating them in the new state of Poland. But in the process, it cut off East Prussia from the rest of Germany. German resentment at territorial losses was amplified in 1922, when, following an inconclusive plebiscite conducted amid heated nationalist agitation on both sides, the industrial belt of Upper Silesia, rich in coal and other minerals, was also assigned to Poland. The deepest anger and resentment of all were reserved for Article 231 of the treaty and its implications. Article 231, later commonly known as the War Guilt Clause, deemed that Germany and its allies were responsible for the war. It provided the legal basis for Germany's liability to pay reparations for war damages, vehemently demanded by a baying public opinion in both France and Britain. The amount of reparations was left to an Allied commission to determine and, in 1921, was eventually fixed at 132 billion gold marks. Huge though the sum was, it could have been repaid over time without crippling the German economy. In the event, most of it would never be paid. Reparations were, in fact, not primarily an economic problem, The real damage was political. They remained for over a decade a cancer in German politics, sometimes receding, at other times recurring, to attack the nation's political health through inciting further nationalist agitation. By the time the reparations were in practice written off in 1932, Germany was in crisis again, and a more dangerous nationalist menace than ever before was looming. The Big Four had faced huge objective problems in attempting to rearrange Europe's boundaries. They were also subject to pressures from the public of their home countries. Unholy compromises were inevitable. Nevertheless, they had produced not so much a framework for lasting peace as a recipe for potential future disaster. The compromises left behind a Europe resembling a flimsy house of cards. For the time being, the new order would hold, if only for the negative reasons that no force was powerful enough to destroy it. But Germany was the lingering problem. Should it ever again become militarily strong, the House of Cards could easily come tumbling down. The Paris peacemakers had contained, but not eliminated, Germany's capacity to cause further problems. The militarism, aggressive nationalism and power ambitions that they had concluded to be the cause of the war were left dormant rather than eradicated. Neither the loss of territory and economic resources nor reparations were enough to cripple Germany permanently. Even the drastic reduction of the size and capability of the army and navy had left the military leadership intact. German military leaders, the economic and political elites, and significant sections of the population inwardly rejected both the terms of the treaty and the representatives of the new democracy in Germany who had signed it. As such, they rejected Europe's new order. Given changed circumstances, they would want to alter it to Germany's advantage. For the time being, Germany was helpless, but a wounded giant. Fragile democracy. A laudable principle had underlain the deliberations in Paris: the intention that the new Europe would be a continent of democracies, of government representing not the interests of unelected princes and landholders, but the will of the people, expressed in pluralist political parties, free elections and parliamentary assemblies. In the first post-war years, representative parliamentary democracy became the model for government everywhere outside the Soviet Union. Even in the Caucasus, a region beset by huge inter-ethnic violence, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan hoped to become sovereign republics before they were conquered by the Red Army during the Civil War, and subsequently incorporated in the Soviet Union. 9 new democracies: Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Poland, Austria, and Hungary, emerged from the ruins of the former Habsburg and Tsarist empires. The Irish Free State was created as a democratic republic in 1922, when the larger southern part of Ireland secured effective independence from Britain, though formally remaining until 1949 a dominion of the British Crown. Turkey became a republic with a parliamentary constitution the following year after a war of independence, the expulsion of Allied occupying armies, and the abolition of the Ottoman Sultanate. European countries adopted democracy partly because the Big Four leaders of the victorious powers, most of all President Wilson, insisted on democratic government as the basis of the new Europe. But even more so, the war itself had been a democratizing process, stimulating pressures for the introduction of democratic rule, mainly articulated by socialists, nationalists, and feminists from within the collapsing monarchical systems. People had been mobilized in vast numbers to fight the war. Once it was over, they demanded change, improvement, representation, hope for the future. The result was a major widening of the political base of society. It was an unstoppable trend. Mass politics were here to stay. The right to vote was extended almost everywhere to include all men and, in some countries, all women. Though even then, not to all women in Britain and not to women at all in France. Thanks to the Senate rejecting a motion that had gained overwhelming backing in the Chamber of Deputies. Political parties were, as a consequence, able to mobilise far larger numbers of voters. The British electorate rose, for instance, from 8 million to 22 million voters between 1884 and 1918. The German from 14.5 million to just short of 36 million between 1912 and 1919. The increased potential for mass mobilisation, of course, also created the potential for political movements to challenge and undermine democracy itself. Channeling, orchestrating and mobilising public opinion was now a vital part of political life. The press had also gained increased power. The scope for manipulation of the masses, also to promote intolerance and authoritarianism, had been greatly widened. Radicalised politics shaped the first turbulent years of peace. A multiplicity of parties emerged in many countries, drawing support from specific sectors of the population or particular interest groups. It was rare to find stability of the kind that underpinned the British political system, in which parliamentary power had long been contested by the Liberals, soon to be replaced as a major force by Labour, and the Conservatives. The British first past the post electoral system, producing a single winner in each constituency, deterred the emergence of small parties, encouraged party discipline in Parliament, and made coalition government the exception rather than the norm, though coalitions had in fact existed between 1915 and 1922. Proportional representation, the system generally favoured in continental Europe, coupled with the major extension of the franchise, tended by contrast to result in irreconcilable parliamentary divisions and weak governments. The spectrum in most countries embraced support at varying levels for communist and socialist, peasant and nationalist, Catholic and Protestant, liberal and conservative parties. Fragmentation and governmental instability were the usual consequences. Socialism made big advances among the working class of industrial areas, but it was almost everywhere divided, as the more militant sections of labour, inspired by events in Russia, became drawn to communism. In much of central, eastern and southeastern Europe, where overwhelmingly peasant populations were concerned above all with the land question, mainly involving redistribution of land from big estates, populist agrarian parties gained widespread, though fluctuating and unstable, support. These often blended into nationalist parties, representing significant ethnic groups in the emerging nation-state, and frequently became a destabilizing factor where there were substantial ethnic minorities or disputed borders. Especially in the new states, trying in usually unpropitious economic circumstances to build a national identity and establish firm political foundations, democracy faced big problems. Mostly, in these early post-war years, democracy in fact survived the challenge. But it was a contested system of government, rejected by powerful elite groups and by some volatile, newly mobilised parts of the population. Only in the economically advanced states of Western and Northern Europe that had proved victorious in the war, Britain and France, or remained neutral, the Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, Belgium and Switzerland, was pluralist democracy an established and generally accepted system of government. Here, the problems of dealing with the post-war social and economic shockwaves were serious and divisive, producing industrial unrest and working-class militancy, often inspired by the revolution in Russia. But the anti-democratic forces were relatively small and could be contained. Apart from Ireland, there were few destabilizing pressures from national minorities. And for all the turmoil in Ireland, which subsided only with the creation of the Irish Free State in 1922, there was consensus behind the idea of parliamentary democracy, leading to a stable two-party political system. With the partial exception of France, where minorities on the left and right rejected the liberal democracy of the Third Republic, the existing form of democratic government enjoyed almost universal backing. There was no crisis of legitimacy. The main problems lay elsewhere. The parliamentary systems in Greece and Bulgaria, for instance, dated far back into the 19th century, though they had long provided scarcely more than a facade for factionalism and clientelism. Popular forces were exploited and manipulated by well-entrenched traditional power elites and oligarchies. Violence and repression were regular occurrences. Post-war Greek governments, destabilized by the disastrous war with the Turks in Asia Minor, were beset by bitter conflict between rival factions of royalists and supporters of the divisive figure of Eleftherios Venizelos, leader of the Liberal Party and, for long, the key figure in Greek politics. But the dominant force, increasingly wielding decisive influence on state power, was the army leadership. A coup by anti-royalist army officers forced King Constantine I to quit the throne in 1922 after the defeat by the Turks. He was succeeded by his son, George II, who was himself forced out 2 years later, this time following a failed coup attempt by a group of royalist officers, who included the future dictator Ioannis Metaxas. In March 1924, the monarchy was abolished, and Greece became a republic. The bitter divisiveness of internal politics thereafter subsided, though didn't disappear. In Bulgaria, exhausted and economically ruined by the war, the Agrarian Union, representing smallholding peasants who had benefited from a substantial land redistribution, formed the largest party, followed at some distance by the Communist Party, founded in 1919, and the Socialists. Government under Alexander Stamboliski, the prime minister and leader of the Agrarian Union, was, however, repressive and corrupt. He made powerful enemies, most dangerously among army officers. By 1923, they were ready to act to end the democratic experiment. Stamboliski was deposed and the army took power. Factionalism and violence, driven both by class conflict and traditional tribal loyalties, were even more evident central ingredients of what was merely a facade democracy in the new state of Albania, created in 1913. The country emerged from wartime partition and occupation by its neighbours, Greece, Italy, Serbia and Montenegro, to enter a brief but troubled period of great instability. Political parties emerged, divided on questions of land reform and the framing of a constitution. But the interests of landowners and clan leaders dominated. Factions formed around two leading figures, Fan Noli, a graduate of Harvard University and bishop of the Albanian Orthodox Church, and Ahmed Bey Zogu, scion of one of the most powerful Muslim families. Torture, killings, bribery, and corruption were regularly deployed by both men and their followers. In a political system closer to neo-feudalism than genuine parliamentary democracy, Noli ousted Zogu, who fled the country in an armed revolt in June 1924. 6 months later, Zogu returned, backed by an army he had raised, including many foreign mercenaries, deposed the government and forced Noli and his followers to flee. In January 1925, the remaining members of parliament elected Zorgu as president, with extended powers for a 7-year term. In Romania, where a pluralist system under a constitutional monarchy had existed since 1881, but where the state had been transformed by the great extension of territory, doubling its size, following the war, the powers of parliament remained weak, while those of the ruling class, the aristocracy, military, Orthodox Church hierarchy, and the upper levels of the bourgeoisie, were strong. Land reform, a response prompted by the threat of Bolshevism, incorporation of ethnic minorities, social mobility, an increase in the urban proletariat, led to overlapping conflicts and continuing internal crisis. In each of these countries, post-war difficulties in overwhelmingly underdeveloped agrarian economies, border disputes and territorial demands, as well as nationality issues, brought with them political tensions. Newly enfranchised sections of the population, especially a politically inchoate peasantry, offered extended room for demagogic mobilization and manipulation. Authoritarianism never lurked far from the surface. There were equally grave difficulties in Spain, where, despite neutrality, the economy had been drastically disturbed by the war. Racked by waves of strikes directed at the authority of the state itself, Spain seemed a country on the verge of revolution. Had it been a belligerent power, perhaps the war would indeed have tipped it into revolution. As it was, the constitutional monarchy, founded in 1876, which had long relied upon an oligarchy of liberal and conservative elites, held on in a grossly unrepresentative parliamentary system. The rapidly growing socialist movement had more than doubled its membership since the end of the war, but electoral discrimination left it with a mere handful of seats. The control of the dominant elites was nevertheless weakening, their liberal conservative political base fragmenting. And 34 governments between 1902 and 1923 contributed to widespread contempt for the feeble and ineffective parliamentary system. The ruling class saw that the state was too weak to uphold their interests. The opponents of the state, primarily within the working class, were, however, too weak to overthrow the system. The result was stalemate. Castigating the weakness of liberalism, there were calls in Spain for a civil dictatorship to head off Bolshevist anarchy. Demands for strong government and the restoration of order, coupled with fear of revolution, forged a coalition of interests ready by September 1923 to support a coup and takeover of power by General Miguel Primo de Rivera. Backed by the army, the Catholic Church, the landed elites, big business and the middle classes, the coup was opposed only by a feeble attempt at a general strike by a demoralized and divided working class. Martial law, press censorship, a single party of national unity, and a corporate structure of labor relations were introduced. The anarcho-syndicalist trade union organization was outlawed, to the satisfaction of its socialist rival, and some leading opposition figures were imprisoned. But Primo's dictatorship was relatively mild, and through a program of public works, it even briefly stirred a sense of growing prosperity in Spain. Above all, Primo succeeded temporarily in restoring order. For most Spaniards, that was what mattered. Few wept tears over the death of what had been no more than a facade democracy. Most people were indifferent. For the time being, counter-revolution triumphed. In the successor states, parliamentary democracy was a fragile flower, planted in less than fertile soil. It faced challenges from the outset by powerful social groups and populist, usually nationalist, forces. But it survived the post-war crisis, even if only Finland and Czechoslovakia proved durable successes. Finland's independence had been established in 1918 only after 5 months of bitter civil war between Reds and Whites, which left as many as 36,000 dead. And a parliamentary democracy was enshrined in the Constitution of 1919. Despite government instability, reflecting ideological divisions between conservatives, social democrats, agrarians, and Swedish nationalists, the determination to preserve that independence against a threat from the nearby Soviet Union underpinned the legitimacy of the new state. The Finnish president, Carlo Juho Stolberg, in the first years of independence, a head of state with wide executive powers, also played a big part through his backing for the still unconsolidated parliamentary system. The same was even more true of Czechoslovakia in the immediate post-war years. The president and effective founder of the state, Tomáš Masaryk, was a convinced democrat, helped by a loyal army, an efficient bureaucracy inherited from the Habsburg Empire, and an economy with a good industrial base pulling out of post-war recession. He was crucial in holding together a system that class and nationality interests in over 20 political parties threatened to undermine. In December 1918 and the first days of 1919, Masaryk used Czech troops to suppress moves to establish an independent republic in Slovakia. He called upon Allied assistance and proclaimed a state of emergency as he deployed new army units commanded by French officers to repel an invasion to recover Slovakia by pro-Bolshevik forces from Hungary in May and June 1919. And he proved adept at appointing a cabinet of officials, independent of divisive party allegiances, to tackle a wave of serious disturbances that summer. The government then used martial law to counter a wave of strikes in November and December 1920, instigated by the pro-Soviet faction of the Socialist Party. This was an important turning point. Thereafter, the Czech parliamentary system held together, somewhat shakily at first, but with increasing authority. The revolutionary left became isolated, as most people wanted peace and order. A broad balance was struck between agrarian interests and those of the industrial proletariat, which was bigger in the Czech lands than in any of the other successor states, but mainly supportive of parliamentary democracy, not communism. Political integration of the Slovaks and also of a sizable German minority, which for now swallowed resentment at various forms of discrimination, kept separatist tendencies at bay. Democracy gradually became stabilized, though implicit tensions were held in check rather than eradicated. In the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, the importance of newly won independence and widespread hostility towards Bolshevism in the neighboring Soviet state helped for the time being to sustain backing for parliamentary democracy, despite unstable governments, which crucially upheld the interests of the big agrarian lobbies while restricting the small communist parties. Democracy remained fragile, however, and government was dependent on the tolerance, which wouldn't prove of long duration, of the military leadership and nationalist paramilitary organizations. In Yugoslavia, the parliamentary system under the Serbian monarchy, established in the Constitution of 1921, was an unpromising arrangement. It represented a narrow victory of centralism over federalism. But separatist tendencies continued to defy government efforts to propagate a sense of Yugoslavian identity in a country of some 20 ethnic minorities and significant divisions of the three main groupings of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. The new state had to combat strong pro-Bulgarian paramilitary forces in Macedonia, as well as separatist pressure for an independent Macedonia, and armed Albanian rebels in Kosovo. It was chiefly threatened by Croat resentment at Serbian domination. No unifying identity could be created, but Croat separatist tendencies were, if with difficulty, kept in check. The Slovenes saw their own language and culture best protected in the Yugoslavian state. Other national minorities were weak and divided, and Italian expansionist ambitions stirred pro-Yugoslavian sentiment along the Adriatic coast. Acute though Yugoslavia's ethnic divisions were, the overwhelming agrarian country had no industrial proletariat to speak of, and the Communist Party, banned and persecuted from 1921 onwards, was thereafter largely insignificant. The country's manifold corrupt factional interests, often benefiting from land redistribution, had more to gain by supporting rather than undermining the new state. Not least, the very structural weakness of a parliamentary system in which proportional representation produced 45 parties, mainly upholding ethnic and regional particular interests, and led to the formation of 24 governments in 8 years, in practice bolstered the dominance of the royal court and its corrupt clientele, the military and paramilitary support organizations, and the security services. For the time being, what in reality amounted to no more than the facade of democracy could continue in existence. In contrast to the manufactured weak sense of Yugoslavian identity, Polish national consciousness had gathered strength during the 19th century. The rebirth of Poland as a state in 1918, following 123 years of partition between Russia, Prussia, and Austria, then the war against the Soviet Union, one of 6 border wars the new state had to fight between 1918 and 1921, provided an initial sense of national unity. This was embodied by Marshal Józef Piłsudski, widely viewed as Poland's saviour, and by a nationalism enhanced by the Polish majority's antipathy towards the country's large ethnic minority populations. But unity rapidly gave way to deep and bitter divisions in a poor country racked by war and the ruinous efforts of hyperinflation. The divisions were partly along ethnic lines. Nearly a third of the Polish population, and in some areas a majority, comprised ethnic minorities. 14% Ukrainians, 9% Jews, 3% Belarusians, just over 2% Germans, among others. Their nationalist aims inevitably clashed and caused tension with the assertive nationalism of the Polish majority. Class divisions were, if anything, even more politically polarizing. Land reform in a country with a large peasant population was a central priority for a grouping of parties of the non-communist left, and steps towards a significant redistribution of land, though with compensation for big landowners, were eventually taken in 1925. But land reform was bitterly opposed by a right-wing bloc of parties, keen to defend the privileges of the propertied classes. The democratic constitution, introduced in Poland in 1921, drew especially on the model of the French Third Republic, and, like its inspiration, led to weak government and an unwieldy, fragmented lower house, called the Sejm, of a two-chamber parliament. A plethora of parties, peasant, worker, minority, nationalities, jockeyed for influence. The main bodies were the bloc of national minorities in which the concerns of the different nationalities often proved incompatible. The conservative National Democrats, upholding the interests of landowners, industry, and a middle class seeking protection against foreign, especially Jewish, influence. The Peasant Party, seeking above all redistribution of land from the big estates, and the socialists, anxious to preserve the substantial gains, including the introduction of an 8-hour working day, they had achieved in the near-revolutionary conditions at the end of the war. Frequent changes of government produced neither stability nor clear policy direction. Democratic government, in the eyes of much of the population, seemed increasingly incompetent, incapable of solving the country's huge problems through a parliament of squabbling politicians who put party interests above those of the nation. The problems mounted when drastic austerity measures were introduced to arrest the hyperinflation, which in November 1923 reached 1.65 million Polish marks to the dollar, and again in 1925, when the recently introduced new currency, the zloty, itself came under pressure and brought about the fall of the government. Democracy in Poland had survived, with difficulty, the traumatic post-war years. But it had never stabilized and become a universally accepted system of government. At times, Poland had seemed on the verge of civil war or a military putsch. Disillusionment with democracy was widespread. There was talk of the need for an iron hand to lead us from this abyss. By 1926, the national hero, Piłsudski himself, declared his readiness to fight against what he saw as the domination of Poland by political parties seeking only the material benefits of office and personal enrichment. It was the prelude to the coup he led in May 1926 and the beginning of authoritarian rule in Poland. Most Austrians, now living in a tiny German-speaking nation-state rather than a huge empire, placed their early hopes in union with Germany, but these were soon dashed by the Allies. Thereafter, there was little basis for political unity. Deep fissures ran as a three-way split between the socialists and the two major anti-socialist political forces. The Christian Socials, the largest party close to the Catholic establishment, increasingly vehement in its Austrian nationalism, and the smaller but vociferous German nationalists who favoured union with Germany. Big armed militias, largely peasant-based and set up to defend Austria's vulnerable and disputed borders, particularly against Yugoslavian incursions in the south from Slovenia, weren't just nationalist, deeply Catholic, and strongly anti-Semitic, but also vehemently opposed to what they saw as socialist rule from Red Vienna. Even within Vienna, socialism was alien to much of the middle class, the state bureaucracy with its strong continuities from the old empire, and the Catholic Church hierarchy. And outside Vienna, socialism struggled. Most of the new Alpine Republic was rural, conservative, patriotically Austrian, ardently Catholic, and fervently anti-socialist. After the initial revolutionary phase, these forces, inherently authoritarian, would grow in strength. From 1920 onwards, the socialists, the main driving force behind the establishment of democracy, played no part in Austria's government. Democracy, associated above all with the socialists, was pushed increasingly onto the defensive. The one country outside Russia where it proved possible to set up a Soviet republic, though of brief duration, was Hungary. A Soviet-style government that assumed power in Bavaria in April 1919 didn't break out of its temporary Munich base before being crushed by the army and right-wing paramilitaries. In Hungary, a weak coalition government of two small liberal parties and the Social Democrats, who relied upon support from only a part of a relatively small working class, was unable to push through necessary social reforms or to tackle the urgent issue of land redistribution in a country where the Magyar nobility retained enormous privileges and ran vast estates with a near servile peasantry. Big demonstrations in towns demanded radical change. Communist propaganda fell on ready ears. Moderate social democrats lost influence. Workers' and soldiers' councils increasingly challenged the power of the government. Agricultural labourers took over some former royal estates. The last straw was when the Allies demanded withdrawal of Hungarian forces facing the Romanians, with the certain loss of territory that this would involve. Refusal of the government to accept the ultimatum on the 21st of March 1919 produced a communist-led government that proclaimed a Soviet republic and dictatorship of the proletariat in Hungary. The 4 months of this regime were a catastrophe. Hasty and draconian state intervention to nationalize the economy and confiscate bank deposits was accompanied by forced requisition of food, persecution of the church, and, amid mounting state-sponsored terror, the arbitrary arrest of hundreds of property owners. Some of these were released only on payment of large ransoms. Others were shot. Several hundred Hungarians fell victim to the Red Terror. As the country descended into anarchy, Hungary faced attack from Romanian, Czechoslovakian, and Yugoslavian forces. By August 1919, the regime was in desperate trouble. It had alienated the middle class, the peasantry, and even the bulk of the working class. The fact that the regime's leader, Béla Kun, and most of the communist commissars behind the Red Terror were Jewish stoked up anti-Semitism. Only help from Soviet Russia could have saved the Hungarian communist regime, and then perhaps just temporarily. But Soviet Russia, fighting for its life in a civil war, could offer no military aid. The failure to export communism to Hungary was the clearest sign that notions of world revolution radiating from the Russian example would have to be abandoned. Béla Kun's hapless government resigned on the 1st of August 1919, just before Romanian troops, by now occupying most of Hungary, entered and looted Budapest. Kun fled, eventually to Russia, where he was to end his life as yet another Stalinist victim. Within months, right-wing nationalist conservatives had reasserted their control in Hungary. Land reform was curtailed. Estate holders were able to hold on to their property and to their power. The military, the bureaucracy, business leaders, and the better-off sections of the peasantry, all horrified by Kun's regime, also welcomed what they saw as the restoration of order through conservative authoritarianism. The war hero, Admiral Miklós Horthy, was consequently able to preside from 1920 as head of state over authoritarian governments that were to last for almost the next quarter of a century. The immediate response to the Red Terror of Kun's regime was the unleashing of a far wider white terror, claiming about 5,000 lives and imprisoning thousands, according to some estimates, in which right-wing officer detachments of the National Army carried out a wave of atrocities directed mainly at communists, socialists, and Jews. Hungary, like Spain, was an exception to the trend in the first post-war years. Democracy, if sometimes narrowly, was generally able to endure the enormous upheavals of this turbulent period. This was in part because across Europe it had idealistic, enthusiastic backing, mainly from the socialist and liberal left, who had long and passionately sought to throw off the shackles of traditional elitist authoritarian rule and envisaged a fairer, more prosperous society in a democratic future. It was mainly, however, because the old order had suffered a shattering defeat at the end of the war. Its adherents were too weak to challenge the establishment of democracy or to overthrow such a new system of government that could call upon extensive, if unstable, popular backing, arising from a combination of social and political interests. The weakness of the elites, coupled with their extreme fear of Bolshevism, meant they were ready to tolerate, if not warmly support, a pluralist democracy that they could often manipulate to their advantage. This could usually be achieved by latching on to populist nationalism, which could be whipped up by heated disputes over border territory. But nationalist parties and movements were themselves mostly divided. The absence of unity on the nationalist as well as the elite right meant that a coherent challenge to democracy could rarely be mounted in the early post-war years. Weakness among the former ruling classes was mirrored to some extent by the weakness and splits on the left. The revolutionary supporters of Bolshevism were nearly everywhere outside Russia in a minority among socialists, who in their great majority backed parliamentary democracy. Often, therefore, what materialized was uneasy survival, where neither the counter-revolutionary right nor the revolutionary left was powerful enough to upturn a newly created democracy. The major exception to the pattern of democratic survival, other than Primo's takeover of power through a coup in Spain, was Italy, the first country and the only one during the post-war crisis in which liberal democracy collapsed to be replaced by fascism. Fascism victorious. A pluralist parliamentary system of government had existed in Italy since unification in 1861. To call it democratic, however, would be to stretch the meaning of the term. Resting on an extremely limited electorate, Italian politics were factional and corrupt, dominated by a small oligarchy of liberal notables. Reform of the suffrage in 1912 almost tripled the size of the electorate from under 3 million to nearly 8.5 million voters, most of them still illiterate. But little significant change to the government system followed. Then came the divisive and traumatic war, which Italy, after much wavering and secret negotiations, eventually entered in 1915 on the Allied side. Immediately after the war, in December 1918, all adult Italian males were given the vote, a reward to the soldiers, and the following year, a new electoral law introduced proportional representation. The hope was to bolster support for the government, but the reform backfired massively. Amid the post-war turmoil, the newly enfranchised population turned their backs on the old liberal politics and voted in large numbers for the newly founded Italian People's Party, Partito Popolare Italiano, representing Catholic interests, and the Socialist Party, which declared its aim to be the violent conquest of political power on behalf of the workers and the establishment of a dictatorship of the proletariat. The socialists professed their allegiance to the Communist International, Comintern, that Lenin had founded in March 1919 in Moscow. At the election in November of that year, they trebled their seats in the Chamber of Deputies, while the populists almost quadrupled theirs. Support for the liberal establishment was strongest in poorer, largely agricultural southern Italy, where clientelist politics still prevailed. But the liberals and their supporters were now in a minority in parliament. Party politics fragmented. Government became destabilized. There were six changes of government between 1919 and 1922, and increasingly paralyzed. Italy seemed on the verge of a red revolution. Throughout 1919 and 1920, which came to be dubbed the Biennio Rosso, the two red years, Italy experienced huge social and political conflict. In industrial cities, there were large numbers of strikes, over 1,500 in each year, factory occupations, worker demonstrations, and looting of shops by crowds angry at price rises. In parts of rural Italy, recently demobilized peasants seized land from large estates, and more than 1 million agricultural laborers joined strikes. as disorder grew alarmingly, as the government was plainly unable to restore order, as fear of revolution and anxieties of the propertied classes about socialism mounted, and as the fragmentation of party politics offered no way through the morass, political space opened up for a new political force. It was to be filled by the fascists. A number of small paramilitary movements, prosaically calling themselves fasci, groups, or literally bundles, the name deriving from the Latin term for the set of rods that had been the symbol of order in ancient Rome, sprang up in the cities and towns of northern and central Italy, amid the political disorder, attracting mainly lower middle class ex-servicemen, especially demobilized officers, and many students. There was no central organization, but what the various movements had in common was the relative youth of their members. Their militant ultranationalism, their glorification of war, their violence, and their visceral dislike of what they saw as the discredited, divisive, weak, and corrupt parliamentary politics of the liberal establishment. Italy's heroic war effort, in their eyes, had been undermined by the political class. Italy could never be great under the leadership of the old notables. They should be swept away. What the fascist militants offered was radical action to renew Italy. This was implicitly revolutionary in that it was directed towards violently and fundamentally changing the existing state. What exactly would replace it was left open. Among the myriad fasci was one founded in March 1919 by Benito Mussolini, a former editor of the official socialist newspaper, who had broken with the socialist left when he fervently advocated intervention in the war in 1915. He viewed the war, in which he had fought and been wounded, as a heroic period in his own and Italy's past. The programme presented at the foundation of his Fasci di Combattimento in 1919 was little different to that of the other fasci, and distinctly revolutionary in tone. Many of its proposals could have been advanced by the left. Universal suffrage, suppression of all noble titles, freedom of opinion, an educational system open to all, measures to improve public health, suppression of financial speculation, introduction of an 8-hour working day, workers to be organized in cooperatives and to share profits, the abolition of the political police, the Senate, and the monarchy, and the foundation of a new Italian republic based upon autonomous regional administration and decentralized executive power. The aim was a radical transformation of the political and economic foundations of collective life. Mussolini was later, however, to disavow what seemed concrete social and political aims, declaring that these hadn't been an expression of any doctrine, but merely aspirations to be refined over time. Fascism, he stated, was not the nursling of a doctrine worked out beforehand with detailed elaboration. It was born of the need for action, and it was itself from the beginning practical rather than theoretical. This was a rationalization, almost 20 years after its beginnings, of the fundamental change that his own movement had undergone within no more than 2 years. For Mussolini, the supreme opportunist, the programme announced in Milan was there to be ignored, bypassed, or adjusted as political needs determined. The socialism of his movement was always subordinated to the aim of national rebirth, a vague but powerful notion that was capable of uniting, at least superficially, quite disparate interests. Principles meant nothing to him, power everything. So, his movement turned from revolution to counter-revolution. Early backing for workers' strikes gave way by autumn 1920 to the deployment of fascist paramilitary squads to break strikes in the interests of landowners and industrialists. The violence of the squads escalated sharply over the following months. Mussolini had recognized that he couldn't defeat socialism and communism by trying to compete for the same base of support. To gain power, he needed the backing of those with money and influence.